Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, this is Teresa Kariakis, coming to you from the Pantheon Podcast Network. I'm on The Devil's Music with Pleasant Gaiman.
Pantheon Podcasts presents from Hollywood, California, The Devil's Music with Pleasant Gaiman. You are invited to join the Hollywood princess as she explores her lifelong pursuits in the occult, sex, love, and that sinful rock and roll. Ladies and gentlemen, step into the dark parlor of Pleasant Gaiman as she brings you The Devil's Music.
Hi, I'm Pleasant Gaiman, and welcome to The Devil's Music, a Pantheon podcast. As the devil himself apparently once said via the Rolling Stones, please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a rock and roll witch from Hollywood, California. My obsession with music and the occult started at the age of 12 and is still going strong. During the 70s, I was one of the first punks in Los Angeles. I worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go and had a Xerox fanzine called Lobotomy, which led me to writing a rock and roll gossip column in the LA Weekly, which in turn led me to writing for every major rock publication you could think of. In the 80s through the 90s, I fronted three bands. I'm a best-selling author with 8 books out and more on the way. For the past 30 years, I've been a professional dancer who's toured around the globe teaching and performing, and you've probably seen me dancing in a number of music videos, feature films, and documentaries. I'm also an actor with several film credits. Find out more about me at pleasantgaiman.com. I'm really excited to be a part of the Pantheon Podcast Network of rock and roll shows. Everyone at Pantheon tells spectacular stories about the music we love so much, each one with a different twist. Find them all at pantheonpodcast.com, as well as on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, radio.com, Pandora, hell, I just had to say that, anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. If you like what we're doing here, head on over to pantheonpodcast.com and share a show with a friend, or I'll put a spell on you. Kidding. This is Pleasant Gaiman, and you're listening to The Devil's Music. Today, my guest is Adele Bertaille. She is so amazing. Her career has just been absolutely extraordinary. She first came onto the radar in the late 70s no-wave scene in Manhattan, or I should say Lower Manhattan, playing with James Chance and the Contortions. But she's done so much beyond that. She's a musician, a singer, a songwriter,
a writer, and she's also a film director. She's worked with everybody you could practically think of, from Brian Eno to Debbie Harry, Thomas Dolby, Tears for Fears, The Pointer Sisters, Culture Club. Need I go on? Probably not, but I'm sure it'll come out in this episode. Adela's laughing now. We've known each other since probably 1978 or 79, but we just reconnected and it's been so much fun. Hi, Adele.
Hi, Pleasant. How are you?
I am good. Both of us are bitching about the Santa Ana winds. It's really windy.
Yes.
In LA.
I know. Don't they call the Santa Anas the devil winds too?
Yes, they do. That's exactly what they are. We're experiencing the devil's wind on the
devil's wind, the devil's music. Actually, a friend of mine, Mary Gateskill, just wrote a book called The Devil's Treasure.
That sounds
good. It's a really great book. You should pick it up. She's an amazing writer, of course, but it's her newest, and it's a reprise of some of her other stories and a little kind of an adult fairy tale. It's really great. So I wanted to plug that for her. Yeah.
So let's where would you like to begin? I'd like to begin like from around the time we met, but you could also just go on with anything that you're working on now.
I haven't recorded music in a really long time. Speaking of the devil's music, I think we need some music to stir up, you know, to speak some truths to what the hell is going on right now. And you know, there are people writing protest music these days, but it's kind of rare to hear it on the radio, that's for sure. But no, I've been really called to start recording again. So I'm going to try and put something out later this year, because it's been a long time since I've opened my mouth.
like a solo record, you mean?
What?
like a solo record.
Yeah, a solo record. It's the year of the water tigers, so it's time to roar and hear the bubbles too, right?
Yeah, totally. All those tigers bubbling underwater, and Carol Baskin's dead husband, and who may or may not be in the water or nested by tigers who are land tigers and still alive. we're getting off to a rollicking start here. No, that's
yes, cool. We are
writing protest music. I mean, because the old protest songs just don't cut it. Any of the ones that we hear that are sort of classic protest songs are just like, I mean,
I know.
Yeah, have you ever listened? But it's just not working nowadays.
No. Have you heard Kay Tempest? She's British. She does kind of like a spoken word, like very cool electron. She's really fucking amazing. She's very radical. She did a record years ago called Europe is Lost. And it's just like, bam, you know, she nails it. She's really great.
But that sounds really cool.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of music about like wet ass pussy and stuff, but there ain't enough about politics.
Well, I mean,
WAP. That's right, baby.
It's pretty political, but I love Cardi B though. I mean, like,
no, I do too. I do.
Especially when she like goes live on Instagram or somewhere and just starts like, I saw one thing of hers. It might have been in 2020. It might have been in 2021. I'm having the pandemic time thing going on now, but it was, it might have been a little bit even before that, because she was in a limo and she was yelling about how her pants were so tight she was going to get a yeast infection. She was sitting in the limo without Spanx on until like the moment that she had to exit the limo. And that's what she didn't like. She was like live, you know,
live tweeting all this.
She was saying it to the camera in the back seat while it was driving.
Oh my God. Well, you know, I'm not allowed to say lady balls, but I would say that's lady balls. You know, there's certain things we're not allowed to say anymore in terms of woke culture.
Oh, because we'd have to say non-binary balls?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We have to say non-binary balls. It's just, I don't know. It's the music of it. It's the music. It's lacking.
You know, like, I mean, speaking of like the psychosis that's going on today, I mean, yes. If I think something's psychotic, it's fucking psychotic. Like a few days ago, this is exactly what I heard in a news broadcast and in this exact sequence. The anchor person was very seriously saying that the green M&M was going to tone down her appearance and not have such long eyelashes, and instead of wearing go-go boots, was going to wear sneakers. Wait, you guys can't see this, but Adele and I are on Zoom, and she's got her hand up her mouth, fucking cracking up.
Pleasant. It's true. I've always wanted to fuck that green M&M. She's so slutty.
But she was such a high femme. Yeah, she was probably a sex worker. But
my God.
But wait. Okay, so it was going on about how she was getting rid of her go-go boots and taking off her false eyelashes and all this shit. And then, without missing a beat, the anchor person went right into. Vladimir Putin is considering like invading the Ukraine, and it was like the M&M came first. I mean, even for someone like me who's taken shit tons of hallucinogenics, I was sitting there having my morning coffee going, what the fuck?
I mean, come on. So the M&M is not allowed to be a high femme?
Yeah,
I mean, what happened? Women aren't allowed to be feminine anymore, or M&Ms? I'm lost. I'm so unfathomably lost. Pleasant. I really am. I'm just lost.
And also, okay, while we're on that little like voyage, after another couple of days, then Stella McCartney. Stella McCartney designed a pantsuit for Minnie Mouse, so she didn't have to wear a dress. Okay, Adele has oxygen to her face right now. I'm not kidding. Get out the smelling salts.
For fuck's sake. Oh my God. Okay.
And now what would you like to talk about now? Just kidding.
I don't know, man. I think maybe we should get off of this topic because it's too loaded. Oh.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with 2 devices at once, new quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
But Pleasant, let's go back to 1977.
Yes.
Were like very heavily involved in the LA punk scene, right?
Yes. Yeah, totally.
Okay. Cool. All right. Because who were the biggest punk bands in, say, 77, 78? In LA?
Mm-hmm. I mean, definitely. I don't, like, still in 77, like, that was when the germs were really coming to the forefront. But there was all these other bands that a lot of people may not know about. But X was definitely, like, just rising right up to the top, and still, I think, is the most classic of all the LA punk bands.
And then, was Alice Bag around?
Yeah, I was just gonna say the Bags, the Screamers. And the Screamers were really, like, revolutionary for you know, not even having any guitars or anything, and Tomato going on stage in a straitjacket, and they had such a really great visual presence, both on stage but also in their artwork, like the screaming face that Gary Panther designed. People still have new buttons of that or new shirts of that, you know. But anyway, Kid Congo and I had been living at a couple of different punk houses, you know, and when we started, when the Mumps came out to New York, and I mean, came out from New York to LA
from New York, in
77. And that was the interview I did for Slash magazine, was with the Mumps, but they never credited the people that did the interviews. But I'd been, like, you know, just a year and a half or so before that, I'd been babysitting people in a tiny little, you know, babysitting kids, toddlers in a tiny little town in Connecticut, and then watching An American Family, like, on television. And so when I found out that the Mumps was Lance Loud's band, you know, and I was already, I didn't yet have a fanzine, but I was already writing for, like, you know, music papers. I'd send stuff out. And I think I was writing for New York Rocker, the West Coast column at that point.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I wrote for them too.
Yeah. I know all the hip girls did. but so I wanted to, so Lance and the Mumps and Christian and everyone, that was my first legit, like, you know, in-person interview. And I told that to Lance, of course, because, you know, I always just spill everything. I was like, I can't believe I love the TV show and blah, blah, blah. And this is the first interview I've ever done. And my parents were writers, but I'd be asking him questions and he'd be going, this is great, you know, stuff like that. And so then we all got to be really, really good friends. And, like, the Mumps, everyone in LA loved them, like, went crazy over them. And so a little bit after that, Kid and I started going back and forth to New York so we could see what the New York scene was like. I mean, we were super interested in it anyway, with that and London and, you know, and with San Francisco too. With anything punk that was going on in those days. And for anyone that's listening, obviously I don't have to tell you, there was only landlines, no social media, no email. And if you got music papers, even from New York, there'd be, like, a week or two lag. And then if you got them from England, they were still coming across on boats, you know, not even on airmail. So anything that you read in them was way outdated. So it took us, we all knew kind of what was going on, but we weren't up to the minute on it. So we decided to get really up to the minute and just go to New York to see what was happening. And we were just amazed by New York. I mean, we'd been to New York City before, but the punk scene was so different than LA, but so amazingly cool. And so we were staying with Christian Hoffman from the Mumps and Bradley Field from Teenage.
And Bradley,
I can still do good impersonations with him. But I think, I know that's how we met you. I don't remember exactly where we met. I can't remember if it was at a party or at Max's or something.
Well, I was in the Contortions at the time. So that, you know, it could have been any of those places. I mean, there were pretty much, like, I would say about roughly 200 people, musicians, artists, filmmakers, poets, you know, and we all kind of knew each other downtown, and we were all collaborating with each other. And, you know, and I think one of the ways it was a little different in New York is that our punk music wasn't so punk. We called it no wave because we were really kind of intent on destroying, like, the basics of pop music, you know, the, like, verse, chorus, power chord thing. Like, for instance, in the Contortions, we were very into funk, but it was, like, this noisy, slashy, funk that was very disjointed. I mean, you can hear it on that song, the contortion song, I Can't Stand Myself, which is a cover version of James Brown.
Yeah.
But it's like so frenetic and nuts. You know, we did that with Eno producing for the No New York record. So it was a really exciting time because everybody was so free, Pleasant. I mean, it was a diametrically opposed time to where we are now. Where we are now, it just seems like, and I feel kind of, you know, bad for kids because they have to brand themselves so strategically and so with such narrow definitions. You know, you are this or you are that. You can't say this, but you should say that. And it's all very conformist. You have to conform to very specific ideals and brands and things. And man, back then we were so fucking free sexually, gender-wise, musically, artistically. It was just this explosion of creativity, and it was wild, and it was so much fucking fun. And gay people were fun.
Yeah, then. They were totally. Yeah, everybody was fun. I mean, that's
everybody was. Yes.
So when I used to, I mean, it was like that in LA too, except we were more influenced by, you know, all the beachier shit, you know?
Sure.
I mean,
yeah. Of course.
But it was originally about 100 people, and then it grew to be about 200 people before it got corrupt by, you know, like all the testosterone, like crazy mush, yeah. You know, that kind of punk. But it was like we had the run of the streets, and in New York I felt like you did, because Kid Congo and I walked everywhere, you know, and mm-hmm. and we would always mm-hmm. bump into people. Like, we used to see Sid Vicious on the street all the time. Bump into, like, you know, it would be like, you know, let's go and sit at Manic Panic for the afternoon, and we'd hang out with like Tish and Sophie, and just people would be coming in there. And I mean, also I think all of us had a lot more time.
Do you want to hear a sad story about Sid Vicious?
Yeah.
So I lived in a building on East 3rd Street between 2nd Avenue and 1st Avenue. And a lot of us lived in that building. Amos Poe, the filmmaker, Jerry Nolan from The Heartbreakers was one of my good buddies. He lived on the main floor, and The Heartbreakers had a rehearsal space in the basement. Of course, everybody was slamming heroin back then because... Yeah. It was, you couldn't swing a dead cat without hitting a fucking bag of heroin in those days.
Yeah, you guys got heroin. Sorry to interrupt you. You guys got heroin way earlier than LA did.
Oh, my God. It was just crazy. So one day it was like, I can't remember what month it was, but Sid had been released from jail after the Nancy Spungen thing, right? Mm-hmm. And he used to do heroin with Jerry. And I don't know if Jerry was dealing to him or not. But I came home one day in the late afternoon, and Sid was sitting on the front steps of the building. And Pleasant, he looked like a ghost. I mean, I've never seen a kid look so devastated, like the despair on his face, you know. And I asked him, you know, if he was waiting for Jerry, and he said, yeah. And he was very monosyllabic. He could hardly talk. I said, listen, come on upstairs. I'll make you some tea until he gets home. You know, we can call him on the phone. So he came upstairs, and I played some reggae or something and just made him a lot of milky cups of tea, you know. And he could hardly talk. And I swear to God, it was kind of like he was already gone, you know. It was like I was talking to a ghost. I felt so bad for him. I mean, Jerry showed up. Eventually, we called him, and he went downstairs. But I'll never forget that visit with him, because he died, you know, well, shortly after that. But it was just so, so sad, you know, and so many of my friends died of heroin overdoses. I mean, George Scott, the first bass player in the Contortions, an amazing guy, adorable. All the girls fucking loved George, you know, died of a heroin overdose. I think he was 21, maybe.
Wow.
So, you know, he was the first one to go, but there were a lot of people that died of heroin back then. And it really was everywhere. And I'm kind of a conspiracy theorist. I feel like, you know, there was so much excitement going on, and there was a political anarchy about it all. And it just seems to me like, wow, how convenient. Let's just dope everybody up so we can take the energy down, way down, you know? It was just too convenient. It was everywhere.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I don't know if you've, I mean, I'm only judging this from a television series, but if you've watched any of those Narcos shows, I think some of it goes pretty true to the way that they functioned in Miami and New York and LA and coming up, you know? So, I mean, that kind of gave me a glimpse into like the through line of heroin, because when heroin came into LA, I'm sure there's always been people doing it since like LA started, you know? I mean, you know, there's been heroin around forever, but when it started coming in, there was an initial part of a tiny trickle of it, and then it just like slammed in. And at one point, I remember feeling like I was like probably the only person I knew that wasn't on heroin. And that was only because my older brother, like much older, had died in New York of a heroin overdose. You know, I was just I'm never going to have a needle in my arm ever, you know?
Right. Yeah. But yeah.
Anyway.
No, I mean, and it was just, we were all so young. That's what was so, that felt diabolical about it, was that we were all so young, and it was, they might as well have just, you know, brought it to our doorstep with a bag of candy and said, here, you know,
here,
kid. That's how ubiquitous it was. It was just fucking crazy. It really was. I mean, I'm pretty gay and, you know, was like all over the place sexually back in those days. But I remember there was a time when every lesbian on the Lower East Side had a copy of William Burroughs's Junkie book next to the bed with a hypodermic needle on the other side.
Okay. I'm glad we're stopping this drug conversation on the lighter side for a second. Let's take a musical break now. And Adele Bertai and I will be right back.
$6 in my hand, up to Lexington, 125, feel sick and dirty, more dead than alive, I'm waiting for my man. Hey white boy, what you doing?
Here's something that has to do with drugs and the late 70s scene in New York. I mean, the in LA, it seems like there's a caste system more, you know, like we weren't associating with like hyper rich people or really famous people as much as it happened to me in New York. I mean, it's happened a lot through the years, but like, I remember, do you remember Anton? The student teacher's roadie. He was a kid from Brooklyn. He was always at CBGB's. He knew the fast. Okay. Anyway, he had a giant, like you know, 60s wood paneled, falling apart station wagon. And one time he just pulled up at CBGB's because anyone that got in the car with him, you know, we could all go to like, it was either a party for Blondie or I think it was a party for Blondie or Blondie was playing. It was some insane thing at Studio 54. And so like, do you remember Liz and Ruth Seidman, the twins?
Yeah.
Sisters. Mm-hmm. Okay. For the listeners, these girls were like 13 and 14 and out at clubs every goddamn night. They were like, they were like barely out of their preteens, verging on 35. I mean, they looked like fairy tale children. They had really pale like skin and really beautiful sort of auburn hair. And they'd be like just smoking like Lucky Strikes or something and just like,
yeah,
fuck that. I don't like that. Or, you know,
well, it's like Howie Pyro's band.
I was just going to say Howie and Nick. Nick were blessed. Yeah, I couldn't believe the amount of like actual children. And I mean, I wasn't even like I was like barely a legal adult then, but I mean, I was like, wow, these are like people that are like 14 that are out at clubs every fucking night. It was
yes. They were like our little brothers and sisters, you know, it was just so funny that the club owners would let them in.
I know. That's what I mean. So anyway, they were all in this Station Wagon with Anton and Kid, and I went, and I mean, probably the student creatures. It was just a carload of people from CBGBs. Right. So I don't even know how we parked or where he put the car or whatever, but like we all just like waltzed in, and there was like that whole Studio 54 line that you hear about of people like dying to get in. We just like marched in. That was actually like in the same way how I went to the Sex Pistols in San Francisco. Like in that case, I was so high, I didn't even think about cutting the line. I just walked right up. After I was already inside, I was like, oh, there's a line.
that was an infamous show. Wasn't that the last show of their tour?
Yes. And yes, it was. Yes. And I was pressed up against the stage and in a crowd of people, and my feet weren't even touching the ground. Let's take a break now. Hi, here we are again. But you know that concert that happened lately? And I think it was in Houston where so many people got trampled to death.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I thought of that immediately when I heard about it, because that was so horrifying. But that could have happened at a number of like crazy punk gigs, but especially Sex Pistols gig. Yeah. I was literally not touching the floor.
Yeah. No, that happened to me at Iggy Pop, an Iggy Pop and the Stooges thing, where I was pressed up against the, you know, the railing. Yeah. Right in front of the stage. Yeah. I was crushed. I thought that was it.
Where was that at?
That was actually here. I think it was at the, theater not Beverly, Santa Monica Boulevard. I can't remember exactly which venue it was, but it was really dangerous. I remember that. It wasn't the Wilshire, but I can't remember which. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
It can be really dangerous, those crowds, you know?
I never thought of stuff like that in the olden days.
No, me neither. Not in the olden days.
And people didn't think of stuff like that on stage either. So I remember always just like one of my favorite things about the New York scene was just people had, New York had its own aesthetic. There was a lot of crossovers in the way it looked, but like LA seemed to be more junk store-ish oriented, you know what I mean? And you know, we perfected the art of dumpster diving Salvation Army before anybody knew that there was gold in them, their boxes. But you guys had all these cool stores like Trash and Vaudeville and people making clothes for you guys. I'm just saying you guys as the collective, because I know it wasn't for everyone, but you know, like Stephen Sprouse making stuff for Debbie. And then what was that girl, Natasha, that used to make the spandex? Because when I first met James's girlfriend, Anya, like she had a lot of really cool spandex. What's her name?
That was Anya Phillips. I think that was Anya making those spandex things.
Anya made that too? Because there was another girl that made like leggings, like they would now be called leggings, but they were jeans made out of spandex that had lines up the sides and stuff. Yeah. But it wasn't a big company. But so Anya made a lot of those.
Oh, she made the stuff that Debbie was wearing, the like real pebbles and bam bam kind of, you know. Yeah. That was Anya for sure.
Anya was beautiful.
She was, yeah.
I remember her and James getting into big fights in the middle of the street a lot. Am I blowing it out of proportion, or was that?
No, I mean, everybody was on drugs back in those days. It was insane. People were insane. They really were. The acting out and the craziness. But back to the fashion, or the anti-fashion, I like to call it. You know, there were a lot of like Jewish clothers that were all in the Essex Street, like Lower East Side area, and they had a lot of dead stock. So there'd be like these really cool dead stock shops where we would shop, like, and girls, you know, there was a lot of androgyny among the girls. Sometimes we'd dress like boys. Sometimes we dressed like, you know, I don't know, Jean Moreau and Elevator to the Gallows. I mean, people were really into like film noir and French, you know, French no wave. So people would pick characters and just play with fashion, and you could, everything was so dead cheap. You could, you know, you could dress like any fantasy for pennies, basically.
Yeah. And we did all that too. You would see some old movie, and then like you could go and just get a dress like that at a studio sale or at someone's yard sale, you know?
Yeah, totally. No, it was incredible. A lot of the guys like John Lurie and, you know, guys like that, they would dress like very kind of 50s, you know, yes. with the Borsellino caps and the hats and the pants with the pleats. And it was just really fun. Everybody was so creative and it was exciting.
That was a really good look that John Lurie had, I thought.
Yeah, for sure. It
looked great. And then like Nick Knox from The Cramps, he always looked like a hitman in a mafia movie.
Yes, exactly.
Or a dug up corpse of a hitman, but a hitman right. nonetheless.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And there were people, you know, the other thing people don't realize is that, and I'm writing about this now, is that there were so many women that came from all over the world to hit that scene, you know. Yeah. Lizzie Mercier from Paris, the Au Pairs from England, the Delta Five, Germany, Malaria, the Girls in Malaria, which was a fantastic band from Berlin. So all of these women were coming from all over the world to New York, to not just to make music, but to make art too. So it was really kind of like the first revolution of women in art. And it happened in New York. And it started in the mid 70s and, you know, went into the 80s somewhat. Yeah. And there were so many great women making art and films and music back then, you know?
Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say in a lot of ways, I think it also inspired the guys because we didn't give a fuck if they didn't like it. So they were inspired by the fact that we were doing what we wanted to do despite, you know, the kind of like sexist gendered roles that we were supposed to be playing. So they would take even greater risks because they saw us taking risks, you know?
Yeah.
It was an interesting time. Yeah.
That is so cool. Yeah. There was stuff like that happening here, but on different levels, but everyone was doing, I mean, this is something that I think a lot of younger people don't understand about early punk and the punk scenes, like in many cities, that there was such an intertwining of music and art and literature and stuff like that. Everyone in those days, everyone read, everybody read. Like you could,
yes,
you know, read, we'd all be reading the same books sort of like through osmosis, not because it was on a bestsellers list or trendy, you know.
Right. Yeah, then, yeah. But it was about outlaw literature.
Exactly.
You know, it was outlaw. It was not conformist. It was not, you know, it wasn't the academy or academics telling us what we should be reading and who was trendy right at that moment. It was about people who broke rules. It was code breakers, you know.
Yes.
And now everything's to code. You know what I'm saying? It's almost Stalinist, and they don't understand that what they're doing. Come on, have some fucking fun.
I got censored. I mean, not censored, but a bot popped up on Instagram not that long ago. Where I was describing a squirrel that I had seen. I couldn't believe this. I was just like, hi, big brother. I was describing a squirrel and I said, this little fatty, and a fucking bot popped up and it said, like, do you really want to post this comment? Comments similar to this have been taken down. Like, as though I was like fat shaming or something. I mean,
oh my God.
Isn't that scary?
It is scary. It's really scary. I mean, I just wrote a book about growing up in the 1960s and 1970s as a working class girl of a racist Italian father, you know, and I'm telling the truth about what it was like at that moment in time in Cleveland as a working class white girl who was queer and having to get the shit beat out of her because of it. Right.
Yeah.
And we used a different language. People, you know, people were racists. People were sexists. People are. And this is our history. So I can't whitewash that. I have to tell the truth of what that was like, what it was like growing up with those people. And yes, it was horribly wrong. But how are you going to know it's wrong if you don't fucking tell the truth? And this is the way people talk.
No, of course, you've got to do that. I mean, people don't understand so much of that stuff. Like, I got an email a few months ago from someone from a book that I had written in 1994. And I was talking about something that happened in the 80s. And I called someone a tranny in the book because that's what everybody called them.
Exactly.
They're like, can you take this out? And I was like, well, first of all, that book's out of print. Second of all, I wouldn't take it out because it's of the time.
Right. Right. You know? But see, that's something else that's happening in LGBTQ culture about that stuff is that there's a whole generation of baby boomers, queers.
Yeah. Yes.
And that we all called each other names, but it was in jest and it was funny. And it was like, oh, you tranny, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And you bull dagger, or, you know, we would call each other names and we would celebrate it in a way like we're taking the power back because we're going to call ourselves these fucking names.
That's
we're
why,
gonna
that's have why,
fun with it.
Yeah, no, I'm, you know, I am queer too. I mean, that's why the word, that's how the word queer came back into use. I'm not saying that to you though. I'm saying that to anybody that's listening.
But you know what I mean? It's like when you try to censor people that are in their 50s and 60s who grew up with a culture where they had to use these words to celebrate themselves and each other.
Yes.
And you're trying to shame them about it. These are the people who got their asses kicked out in the street for you for 20 years so that you could be who you are today. Don't fucking shame them. Don't you dare. You know, you can talk however the fuck you want to talk right now, but don't shame the ancestors who fucking fought in the streets for you, getting their asses kicked.
That's it.
You know what I mean?
This is exactly true too. This is like when, I mean, there was actually, like, over the years, I don't know exactly what it's like now because of the pandemic and stuff too. But I mean, there was, I remember when gay men, I remember the days when, like, I would walk into some club and I'd be like, I'm bi. And then if there was dykes around, they would just be, oh, you just haven't met the right girl yet. Do you know what I mean? And
of course, yeah.
But nobody believed in bisexuality.
Right,
in those days, you know, it was like, you had to be one or the other. And then there was so much hate of women, like all the guys, not all of them, but a lot of them would, do you remember when they would call women fish? And just be you. And then when they call like a straight couple or even just a woman a breeder, and like as though it was the most disdainful term that you could apply. And I remember when like same-sex couples started adopting babies and when it was first coming out in LA, and you'd see West Hollywood like full of strollers and stuff. And I felt like going, now who's the fucking breeder asshole? There's nothing wrong with wanting kids. I mean, I never wanted kids to like breed them, you know, and I didn't have kids anyway, but that's beside the point. But what's not to love about having a baby? Come on, you know, and you were acting like it was some like hellish thing. And now look at you.
Right, exactly. No, but I'm not saying that culturally, like gay people were sacrosanct in the old days, but I'm saying, you know, that there's a Stalin-esque element to this kind of like language shaming that's going on. That is just, it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction to, and I understand, listen, if we could get rid of the fucking binary, I would be very happy. But it's not going to happen if you're shaming everybody about the words they use constantly. That's just going to make people angry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not going to work. It's going to boomerang. There's got to be different ways and different nuanced ways of us speaking to each other and trying to understand each other in a common language that's not so mean and ugly and aggressive and shaming and bullying. there's so much bullying that's going on. You know, I don't remember this happening when, like, before, you know who, Twitler, that fucker, like, it just seemed to ramp up, like, you know, exponentially, like 8,000%. He gave permission for people to be ugly and mean and bullying, you know, and it happens just as much on the left as it does on the right.
No, it happens. You know? It happens across the board. It doesn't even matter. I think what your political or sexual affiliation is or anything. I think online bullying too. A lot of people say that, but there's also this other kind of like swing in the opposite direction, like in LA here, like no one says homeless anymore. Everyone says our unhoused neighbors and stuff like that, which I mean, I can agree that we're all humans, but like my unhoused neighbors in the part of LA that I live in look like meth head reinterpretations of like a Mad Max movie, but without the cool costumes and the flying machines and stuff. I mean, my unhoused neighbors are horrifying. They're straight out of like Night of the Living Dead.
Well, exactly, because this culture, American culture, is fucking insane. It's insane. I mean, I have an unhoused neighbor who practically stabbed my other housed neighbor the other day, you know? I mean, listen, the fact that people cannot afford a house to live in or an apartment to live in is catastrophic. And this is capitalism gone fucking berserk, you know? And we're living in this kind of like Alice down the rabbit hole with it all, because it's gone completely mad.
Yeah,
it and has people, been. It's just, yeah. We're, I think it's the end. It's totally the end of the empire. It might even be the end of the world. But here's the other thing that's very scary is this thing with COVID. Okay, this two plus years of COVID and all these people that were let go of their jobs and these big corporations that, you know, where tens and thousands of people have lost their jobs, like maybe more than 100,000 people, they're not getting those jobs back because they're replacing them with AI.
Yeah, AI. I know.
AI is coming.
Yeah.
AI is here and it's going to keep developing and they're going to keep putting people out of work and there's going to be more unhoused neighbors and it's just going to get worse and worse.
No, it's
I hate to say it.
For all you younger people listening, like Adele and I are absolutely sure that we are witnessing the decline of Western civilization, and we're not talking about the Penelope spirit.
That's right.
Because what we wanted to do when we were younger was break down a bunch of walls and stuff, but now the walls are crumbling around us because there's no fucking infrastructure, and the people that are running this whole mess are out of their fucking minds. Like if they thought we were insane during punk rock during the late 70s, like I look at some of this shit coming out on the news, and we're not even talking now about the green M&M, and I mutter the words "what the fuck" more than I did like if I was getting arrested in 1980 or something. You know,
like. No, it's just baffling. It's just, thank God we have friends that we can laugh with about it, because otherwise I would be weeping from dawn to dusk, you know, because it's really tragic what's happening out here.
No, it's in LA, but I mean, have you talked, I'm sure it's happening like all over the country.
Oh, it is.
Maybe not to the same degree, but
I don't think the unhoused situation is quite as bad as it is in California.
No, because the weather, like the weather that's going on right now on the day that we're recording this across like all of the Midwest and the East Coast is like,
yeah,
like no airlines are running, and it's not, you know, it's just because of like the snowstorms and the crazy.
Yeah.
But we're not going to go into like, any climate change bullshit.
Let's just take a little beeline around that, please.
Yeah, this is the most political devil's music that we've ever had.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Ah,
usually, one time my producer said, is it a prerequisite that all your guests took major amounts of hallucinogenics? And I was like, no, just a coincidence.
Speaking of hallucinogenics.
Yeah.
Okay. You know that song? I told you about that song I did like quite a long time ago called Can't Stop the Dance.
Yes.
Okay. That song is kind of like a fucking Wagnerian opus. It's like the witch's revenge song. And I was thinking about it because who was I talking? I think I was talking to Lydia Lunch about this. The fact that witches, do you know that they killed between 200 and 500,000 witches in Europe in the, I think it was like between the 14th and 16th.
Yeah, like around the time of the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah, almost 500,000, somewhere between 200 and 500,000.
Did you hear that a bunch of Scottish witches got pardoned like a couple of months ago? I mean, people that had died in those times.
Really?
Yeah.
But, and they brought them back up and pardoned them?
They didn't exhume them.
They rose them from the dead. Exhumed them?
Somebody on Twitter, I never thought I'd say a sentence like this until very recently. Somebody on Twitter said, a little late now, isn't it? But yeah, so let's talk about some witchy stuff, because have you noticed that like witchy stuff is so it's still all the rage. It's been building and building for a few years, and it, to me, I compare it to punk rock.
Yes, no, I agree. I think it's incredibly empowering. I mean, this is why they wanted to kill us all, because you know, women have such incredible power. And, you know, the witches back in the old days, they really knew about herbology, and they, you know, they were very close to nature. They knew which herbs to use to heal and, you know, and to poison. But what was I thinking? I guess there was a time when they would make these salves out of,
you mean, are you going to talk about flying ointment?
Yes.
I want flying ointment more than I wanted to get Spanish fly from a street vendor in Tijuana.
I think we should start trying to work on some flying ointments, don't you?
We should, yes, I think so. We should start a band together called Flying Ointment.
No, but they were saying that that's what the whole broom riding thing was about.
Yeah.
That the brooms were like, you know, dildos, like anointed with flying ointments.
It's hallucinogenic or something.
Yes.
You guys were not making this shit up. For all of
making
you guys.
Making this shit up, boys.
Oh my God. Witch. Okay. Witch. I mean, W-H-I-C-H, not W-I-C-C-H. Yeah. Yes. When you said that, it just made me think this is so wrong. That made me just think of the Born Innocent movie with Linda Blair, who was playing a possessed girl in another movie called The Exorcist at the same time. In Born Innocent, she got raped in jail with a broom. I think it was.
Oh, that's so horrible.
No, that was horrible. But that I just thought of that when we started talking about flying ointment. Right. Oh my
God. No, but seriously, like Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Vile, they wrote this thing, you know, a song called Pirate Jenny, and
I love that. Yes.
I can't stop rewriting Pirate Jenny. It's like I've done my own version of it.
You should sing it. Can you sing it a cappella? Tell us the words.
Und ein Schiff mit Absegen und mit 40 Kanonen wird entschwinden mit mir. That basically, that what that says is a big ship with 50 cannons will disappear with me. Because I'm wearing the flying ointment.
Is it because of flying
no,
ointment?
Just kidding.
Or you're just saying
that? No, I made that part up. No, but that, you know, that was the translation, that the ship is going to come and they're going to blow up all you motherfuckers and I'm going to disappear with this ship. I mean, that's basically the story of Pirate Jenny, but Can't Stop the Dance is my version of Pirate Jenny.
Okay, well, let's listen to that right now.
It's nuts. It's like Wagner. All right.
I can't wait. Okay, here, Adele and I have come back from our flying ointment excursion, and we're back with you again.
We're back on the ground. Here we are. So this has really been a lot of fun. Is there anything else we should talk about before I go?
I don't know. I was just thinking how there was like, I was really just now off the top of my head thinking there was sort of a lot of explosion of occult music in the 70s, right before and right around punk rock, like especially Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, there was like a group called Pentangle. And it was all that, there's always been a lot of like witchy shit and rock and roll together. And
yeah,
because
Kate Bush did a great song, yes. Great witchy song too, called Lily. Remember that
Lily.
Song?
That was great. But of like this, the Fleetwood Mac stuff, I didn't appreciate it at the time, even though it was super witchy, because I just wanted to hear stuff like, you know, the contortions or the down. Other stuff. But I also remember when Exene and Lydia came out with Adulterers Anonymous, and people were like muttering around, at least out here, you know, that they looked like a couple of witches and stuff. And both of them have like really struck me as like witchy in the way.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. For sure. But you know, I also think that if you're really a witch, you're not going to be proclaiming it to everybody either.
Yeah. You know yes. I mean? And no, I mean, now everyone talks about everything on Instagram or wherever. I mean, because there's no, it seems like that. I don't know. I mean, especially since the pandemic too, it seems like there's no, you know, except for like, you can't show boobs or whatever on most social media. I mean, people are saying the wildest shit I've ever seen and making true confessions. And I mean, this isn't even just people I know, you know?
It's But the thing that's interesting about, you know, the whole witch thing is really, it's about metaphysics. It's about people like the idea of the coven or a group of people concentrating on the same intention.
Yes.
And how powerful that can be. I mean, I really do believe that thought can move, you know, can actually create manifestations. Also sound can move matter, and they're just starting to, you know, really learn how powerful sound vibrations can move matter. And that's something that can be used for either really good or really evil, you know,
like the Havana
thing. Yeah. So,
I mean, I've heard stuff that like it Coral Castle, as well as the pyramids. Coral Castle was this mansion in Florida that the guy built through like electromagnetics and sound. I mean, that is surmise.
Wow.
Not a fact, you know, it's not a fact, but all of that kind of stuff is absolutely just fascinating to me. Like we don't know so much about many things.
Many things, but you know, I really think, you know, that's a huge fascination of mine is the sound thing, because there's just been so many phenomenons in, you know, like the pyramids that just seem like they're just completely impossible. How did they do that? And then, you know, you can see these experiments that people do with like a thin plate of metal, and they'll put like sugar or sand on top of the metal, mount a speaker under it, and play certain musics, and depending upon the music, it'll create these incredibly beautiful patterns or these incredibly gnarled, dissonant, weird patterns physically. The sound, you know, the sand or the sugar, you know.
That's like playing music for water, like when they're blessing water, and like you can, if they were playing, like let's just pretend they were playing some kind of like wild, like punk rock or like some kind of a noise band or something, the water wouldn't come out. Like it would come out in a way where if someone drank it, they'd be stressed out. But if they played like beautiful lilting classical music or some kind of like nice notes, then the water actually was sweeter, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Even like, who's that guy? There's a Japanese guy that would take glasses and he would write a word on the glass.
Yeah.
Right. And it would infuse the water with whatever that word was, or it's just so interesting. Like, you know,
that's like
how
that's
thoughts. Like, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say, yeah, this is all like the, you know, what a lot of metaphysics and witchcraft is. It's thoughts, intentions, words. I was just writing about that today because I'm going to be teaching a class on that kind of stuff, like in August.
Like, that's great.
Yeah, but I mean, like words and what people repeat to themselves, what you would either get tattooed on yourself or what you write. If you write something down on a piece of paper, even this is like a super easy little thing, but it's words spoken or written, but written I feel is more powerful because it's coming out of the ether of your head and onto a page or onto a candle or something.
Right.
That just makes it really a lot more real, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And ritual, you know, ritual is really important. People need ritual.
Yes.
I mean, that's why people love to go to live music concerts, because they're all together celebrating something together.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a vibration. It's a musical vibration. And I mean, we need rituals so badly. I spend a lot of time in Trinidad, in the island of Trinidad.
I'm so jealous.
Oh my God. We'll talk about it sometime. Carnival culture there is so amazing. Here's the difference. You're born in Trinidad, and the moment you're a little kid that you're cognizant, they put paints in your hands and teach you how to make masks or how to play a steel drum, or you're totally encouraged toward art, you know, in all of its manifestations. And it's not an elitist thing at all. Everybody participates in making art and music throughout the year in preparation for Carnival, which is like a week of ritual.
Yeah.
It's a week that everybody participates in. Therefore, the culture, everybody's like really happy and they're sexy and they're sensual. And it's just, it's such a beautiful culture. So chilled out. So different from American culture, where everybody's got a fucking gun and a, you know, an insult for every, I mean, it's just night and day. And that's an African East Indian culture, you know?
Yeah. No, amazing.
It's, yeah. And it's just, we have the fact that America, you know, the white establishment of America could ever dare be influenced by a Black and East Indian culture, that maybe psychically they've got something going on that you're really missing, buddy. You know what I mean? It's like that would never occur to them. I mean, this white European male fucking thing that's just killing us all. Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. That's absolutely fine. Yeah, I'm really interested in all that kind of stuff and colors and all of that,
like
all the good vibrations.
I know they throw paint pigments at each other. Everybody's like colored in, you know, like different colored paints, dancing in the streets.
That's kind of like Diwali, sort of in India.
Yes,
yeah,
it's a combination of Diwali and like African celebrations, and because it's kind of a hybrid of all this like wonderful stuff, you know. Wow. If you ever get a chance to go to Trinidad around Carnival, or even a month or two before Carnival, because everybody's prepping for it, it would blow your head off. It's so amazing. It really is.
You know where else I really want to go before we do this? I don't know. Have you ever heard of Saint Marie de la Mer?
Is that in France?
Yes. And it's
is it supposed to be where Mary Magdalene came over or something?
Yes, but it's also like the Black version.
The Black Virgin. Yes, the Black Virgin.
The Black Madonna. Yeah. It's like a huge Romani festival.
Ah, that sounds great too.
Yeah, that's
well, there's that whole area of France, like what's it called? The Carcassonne, I think it's called, where it's a very mystical area of, I'd love to go there too.
I just want to go to all the mystical places in the whole goddamn fucking world.
Let's get a coven together and go.
Let's get on our brooms and grease them up.
Let's get grease them up, baby.
Okay, I think I'm on that note, if that's a good ending note. Will you listeners come with us, please? We'll let you know when it's
happening. Yes. Come along with us on our merry, merry, witchy way.
Okay, well, that's been Adelbert Tye. Isn't she fabulous? We could have probably just gone on and on and on and on. And maybe we still will after this episode ends for you guys. Anyway, Pleasant Gaiman signing off with the Devil's
Thank Music. You. Thank you, Pleasant. It's been so much fun. Thanks.
Thank you, Adele. It's been so awesome. And see you guys for our next episode. Bye.
Bye.
Myself understood. He's slipping through the streets of my heart. He's sliding round in my brain. I'm gonna leave that boy for Marseille before he make me insane.
The Devil's Music is written and hosted by Pleasant Gaiman. Produced by Aaron Alden. All sound design by Jerry Danielson of Busy Signal Studios. And of course, is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at pantheonpodcasts.com. Our social presence is at Pantheon Podcasts on Facebook and Instagram. Tweet us at Pantheon Pods. All songs can be found wherever you get great music. Please pick up these important and fantastic tracks. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.